From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. The federal law that governs fishing activity throughout the country is up for reauthorization this year. The Magnuson-Stevens Fishery and Conservation Management Act was first passed in 1976, primarily to address the problem of foreign illegal fishing and to promote the domestic fishing industry. However, changes to the law in 1996 and 2006 shifted focus toward more stringent regulations to prevent overfishing from threatening the populations of important fish species. As lawmakers on Capitol Hill work to reauthorize the MSA, some commercial fishing interests say catch limit restrictions are cutting into their bottom line, but environmental advocates warn that overfishing remains a problem that threatens both the marine environment and the future of the industry. We'll also explore a recent study from Audubon, Florida, and the Pew Charitable Trust about the importance of forage fish to coastal birds in the marine ecosystem. First, this news. From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Lawmakers in Washington this year are expected to update the federal law that governs fishing activity throughout the country. The Magnuson-Stevens Fishery and Conservation Management Act was first passed in 1976, primarily to address the problem of foreign illegal fishing and to promote the domestic fishing industry. However, changes to the law in 1996 and in 2006 shifted focus of the MSA more toward regulating catch limits to protect the population of fish species and ensure future viability of the industry. While some commercial fishing interests say tight fishing regulations are cutting into their bottom line, that could be a concern as the commercial seafood industry in the U.S. accounts for some 1.5 million jobs. Still, others argue that stringent MSA regulations are needed to prevent continued overfishing of important fish stocks. Joining me now for a closer look at the state of the industry, federal fishery management regulations, and their economic and environmental impact is Will Ward. He's the Tampa-based CEO of Captain's Finest Seafood and a master captain licensed as a merchant marine. Ward is also a member of the Gulf Fishermen's Association Board of Directors and the Gulf States Marine Fisheries Commission. Additionally, he serves on advisory committees to the Gulf of Mexico Fisheries Management Council. Will Ward, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Good morning, John. Glad to be here.
Also with us from Tallahassee is Holly Benz with the Pew Charitable Trust. She's the organization's director of U.S. Oceans Southeast. Thanks for joining us this morning, Holly.
Glad to be here.
We're also on the line with Captain Mike Colby with Double Hook Charters and Clearwater. Thanks for your time, Mike.
Well, thanks for having me, John.
And we're speaking with Bob Gill, owner of Shrimp Landing. He's a former chairman of the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council and is currently appointed to the Gulf Council's Scientific and Statistical Committee, as well as being a member of multiple advisory panels on the Gulf Council. Bob Gill, welcome to the show.
Good morning, John. Thank you for having me.
I invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. If you have a comment or question for our guests, phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And Will, I'll start with you, and Mike and Bob, feel free to jump in here as well. But since it was first passed in 1976, has the Magnuson-Stevens Act been successful in protecting different species populations from overfishing?
John, it's been a mixed bag to begin with, but there have been some major accomplishments and or major introductions of legislation that have tried to attempt to get the ball moving in the right direction. In 1996, the Sustainable Fisheries Act, and of course, the 2006 reauthorization of the Magnuson Act also put more teeth into rebuilding stocks. And those two authorizations and amendments to the original Magnuson Act have done the most to, in actuality, help rebuild fishery stocks in this country.
And Will and Bob, you both have been associated with the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council. How is that organization involved in, say, you know, implementing some of the regulations put in place by Magnuson-Stevens?
Well, John, they don't implement. What they do is they recommend to the Fisheries Service changes that should be made. And then, assuming the Fisheries Service agrees with those recommendations, they then implement them into the fishery management plan and throughout the Gulf.
So it really is sort of localized how regulations are put into play, or how, I guess I should say, suggestions are made and put into place.
Very much so. They start at the council level with input from stakeholders and go through a rather long, and which is a good and bad situation, but a rather long process involving a lot of stakeholder input before final decisions are made.
And have we seen important fish populations rebounding under Magnuson-Stevens in, say, the last decade or so?
If that question is for me, the answer is an unqualified yes. Just look at red snapper. There's red snapper off the west coast of Florida that hasn't been there for years. It's come at a bit of a price. You know, the stocks have rebounded in many fisheries, but on the other hand, lately the economic impact has been rather strong as well. So a balance, in my view, is needed, but we have been very successful in having stocks rebound.
Will Ward, has that been your experience as well?
I would agree with Bob in that we have seen a major rebuilding of a number of species that, to the levels of at least the 1970s, in the case of red snapper, for example, John, Bob's spot on regarding red snapper. It's made major an increase in the population since enactment of rules and regulations. But I think in addition to the issues of the economic price, although it has been an economic price, an argument could also be made that there is an economic benefit for rebuilding these stocks in the long run, and that short term there has been a price, there's no question about that. But the long term sustainability and viability, economically speaking, of the growing concerns of the seafood industry, the charter boat, head boat industry, is enormous if we stay on track to rebuild the fisheries. Now, that's something that, you know, of course, you're probably going to get differing views and perspectives on, and I can respect other people's views on that. It's just that I also know what promise it holds if we rebuild these stocks back to what they could be, in historic levels. The economic drivers to the communities of Florida through Texas will be enormous.
And Will, do you kind of see yourself as sort of in the middle? I mean, here you are, you know, obviously representing the interest of commercial fishermen, but at the same time, you know, there's this understanding that if we overfish them now, then it's just going to hurt the viability of the industry in the future if we deplete fish stocks. Is that something?
Well,
go ahead.
Bob Gill was absolutely correct that there are a number of folks in our industry, both in the charter boat, head boat, and commercial industries, that have had a very hard time here recently, economically it is. But the concern that I have is that if we continue to kick the can down the road from the scientific perspective, we'll be paying the price for this years and years and years to come. And so although it has been a tough pill to swallow, I agree, there's no question. That pill to swallow, on the other side of that coin, there's so much more benefits to come out of this if we do it the right way. I know that there's some new introductions of bills, or drafts, I should say, in the Hastings draft of the House that would like to see more flexibility in that, in rebuilding fishery stocks. I would caution against that for this reason, that in the past, we've tried to think about ways to be flexible in rebuilding stocks, and all that's happened is we further eroded the ecological base and sustainability of fisheries. So we've got to be very, very careful. Red snapper have come back, but we could very easily reverse all the benefits of the red snapper fishery in the last 10 years within a matter of a few years. So I'm just very cautious. I think science, there's a scientific basis for doing such a thing in terms of flexibility. I'd be willing to listen to that, but it's strictly about trying to avoid responsibility or kick the can down the road. I wouldn't be one that would advise that as an industry representative.
Gotcha. And you know, as it relates to reauthorization of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, you know, recreational and commercial fishing interests did testify on Capitol Hill back in November before a Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation subcommittee that Congress should relax catch limits in the Gulf of Mexico and the South Atlantic. And they were using as a reason, you know, some of these fish stocks that we have been seeing come back. But you're saying don't reverse course now. We need to stay the course. As far as, you know, reauthorization of Magnuson-Stevens, what needs to be modified?
Yeah, John, I'd
Holly?
Be happy to jump in on that. Sure.
Sure.
I think that what we need to do is, rather than reverse course and go back to a time where we allowed rampant overfishing, and as a result had, dozens of fish species that were heavily depleted. We should instead build on our success and look to continue to rebuild those populations that were heavily depleted, not allow overfishing to happen. But we also want to look ahead and make sure that our fisheries and our ocean ecosystems are resilient and able to withstand some of the challenges that they're going to be facing, particularly with warming ocean waters and more acidic oceans. We need to make sure that the ecosystem is resilient, and that means protecting the ocean food web and considering interactions between predators and prey. It means making sure that there's plenty of the forage fish, those small nutrient-rich fish, towards the bottom of the food web that are a critical food source for predator species like snappers and groupers and tunas and seabirds and a whole host of other marine wildlife. It means making sure that we're reducing a destructive practice called bycatch, which is the unintentional catch of some species of fish and sea turtles and seabirds and other marine wildlife that usually are just thrown back dead and wasted. That's an incredibly destructive practice, and we need better ways to account for that and to reduce it. That's the important thing, is we need a law that's ready to face the challenges of the 21st century, and that's really what we're looking to see in this reauthorization.
And Holly, in your mentioning of the importance of forage fish, let's take a closer look at this recent report from Pew Charitable Trust in Audubon, Florida, titled Fins and Feathers, Why Little Fish Are a Big Deal to Florida's Coastal Water Birds. This study primarily looked at the role small forage fish play in the larger food web. Tell us some of the key findings there.
Sure. So the report, Fins and Feathers, examines the crucial link between birds and the diverse array of small fish that are a critical food source for these coastal water birds and as well as other marine wildlife. Declines in the populations of these fish that are known as forage fish or bait fish could really threaten imperiled birds like brown pelicans, roseate spoonbills, black skimmers, or other birds that are really iconic and beloved by folks in Florida and around the world. So we looked at this and came up with several recommendations. And the most important thing is that when fishery managers set limits on the amount of fishing for forage species, they really need to account for the forage needs, the dietary needs of coastal water birds, before you start to expand the current levels of fishing or allow fishing for new species to begin. We also need to make sure that there is a sufficient abundance and variety and size of forage species, because different types of predators, different types of water birds need different sizes and types of these forage fish in order to feed their young. We recommended identifying, mapping the important foraging areas for coastal water birds that are nesting and areas that are subject to forage fisheries, and figure out where there's the overlap for these areas and activities so that we can consider what conservation and management options are needed to avoid or minimize the conflicts. And then we also recommended protecting important forage fish habitat like mangroves and seagrasses.
All right, so these are recommendations for, it looks like they could be implemented both on the state and federal level. What fish species are we talking about specifically when we say forage fish? I know there's quite a variety.
Sure, it's a variety. It's things like mullet and menhaden, sardines and anchovies. Those small fish, they're usually schooling fish. They're very oily and nutrient-rich, which means they help to transfer energy up through the food web to the larger predator species. And that's why they're so critically important in the ocean food web.
And these birds that would be or are being impacted, by the loss of forage fish here, they're already facing threats from habitat loss, correct?
Yeah, these birds have faced steady pressure from a loss of habitat. And this is an area that's been, to date, not very well considered and sort of been not really a focus of bird conservation efforts. And so we thought it was a unique opportunity to team up with the experts at Audubon, Florida, to really take a deeper look at this issue.
And did this report's review of scientific literature reveal that there's actually a great deal we don't know yet about the diets of coastal birds and precisely how they depend on forage fish?
That's right. We know that there are, these forage fish are an important part of the diet for many coastal water birds, but there's a lot more that we could learn.
And besides just their importance to coastal bird populations, aren't forage fish an important food source for, say, larger fish species, or aren't they also commercially important?
They are. There's these forage fish make up the diet for a number of predator species, like, you know, and species that we like to both catch recreationally on the weekends, as well as fish that we like to see on our dinner plates or on restaurant menus here in Florida. We're talking about things like snappers and groupers. We're talking about snook and tarpon and sea bass. There's a whole variety of marine wildlife that depend on this incredibly important, host of small fish called forage fish, and that's why we think it's incredibly important that we are particularly focused on ensuring that we're not just leaving enough in the water for them to reproduce effectively, which is sort of the normal standard for how you manage fish populations. You make sure that you're not taking them out of the water faster than they can reproduce. With forage fish, you need to basically leave extra in the water so that they can serve their role in the marine ecosystem as prey for these other predators.
And besides overfishing, do forage fish face threats related to water quality? And by that, I'm even kind of referring here to Southwest Florida, the excess nutrient-laden freshwater that's released down the Caloosahatchee River from Lake Okeechobee in the rainy summer months, and then the lack of enough water flowing from the lake in the dry winter months. Can't that disrupt salinity levels in estuary habitats where many of these forage fish species can be found?
It's true. The environmental factors like that can have an impact on forage fish populations, which makes it all the more important to be careful that we're monitoring these populations and that we have the right rules in place to ensure that we've got a sufficient abundance and diversity of them in the water. Otherwise, we could have a sort of ripple effects throughout the food web.
And how exactly was this, the information gathered in this report, put together? I understand you went back and looked at some, more than 70 years of data and peer-reviewed studies.
We worked with Audubon Florida. Their researchers did a good bit of the primary research and looked at a number of sources, did a pretty thorough literature review, looked at all the peer-reviewed scientific literature, and working together with them, our researchers and those at Audubon Florida came together to put it together in a way that makes sense for the layperson and also to make some recommendations about what we could do to move conservation of both forage fish and coastal water birds forward here in Florida.
And, according to the research, commercial anglers caught some 17.5 million pounds of forage fish in 2012. That's at a value of $9.14 million. Currently, are there regulations in place to protect the sustainability of forage fish populations?
Florida, back in the 1990s, Florida voters passed a constitutional amendment commonly known as the net ban, and it essentially limits the use of a lot of most types of gill nets, and that's that catch fish by the gills. And that has done a good deal to increase the populations of forage fish in Florida's coastal waters. But as you mentioned, even with this, the ban on certain types of nets, the catch of sort of the main seven types of forage fish in Florida is still pretty significant. And in fact, for comparison, the catch of mullet, probably the largest forage fishery in Florida state waters, in the last few years has been on a par with and sometimes even larger than the total catch of red snapper in the Gulf of Mexico. So despite the net ban, we're still looking at a pretty significant sized commercial fishery for some of these forage fish.
And, as far as, future reauthorization of the MSA, do you think forage fish protections are likely to be in there this year? Or is that something you'd, of course, like to see?
Something we'd like to see, and I think that I would expect that there will be proposals to consider the important role of forage fish in the next Magnuson reauthorization. Around the country, from the West Coast, New England, the Mid-Atlantic, all on the East Coast, steps are being taken by managers to more effectively protect this most important link in the ocean food web. And so I would expect to see that this action at the local and regional level to start to really trickle up into national legislation.
We're speaking with anglers and fishing industry representatives Bob Gill, Will Ward, and Mike Colby, along with Holly Benz with the Pew Charitable Trust, about the reauthorization of the federal law governing fisheries in the U.S. The Magnuson-Stevens Fishery and Conservation Management Act is up for reauthorization this year. Call 1-877-GCU-TALK to join the conversation. That's 877-428-8255. Or post your comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And we had mentioned there's a draft Magnuson-Stevens Act reauthorization that's out from a House Committee on Natural Resources. Have any of you had a chance to see to look through that and see kind of what changes are included in the draft?
Well, from a fisherman's, if I could jump in there, John.
Absolutely.
From a fisherman's industry standpoint, I have not read the entire document. I've perused through it and looked at some of the high points, some of the bulleted numbers in it, items in it. And it's what it does is it's borrowing from a host of federal legislation back in 2011 and 2012, which I've testified on before the House Committee on Natural Resources and the Subcommittee on Oceans and Insular Affairs. And it borrows a lot from a language that was contained in the Saving Fishing Jobs Act, the Fishery Science Improvement Act, American Angler Preservation Act, and other legislative efforts that were geared at setting the table for the main course, which was the reauthorization of MSA. And some of the language that's being proposed in this draft, changing words from overfished to depleted, making a different rules and guidelines for how a regional fishery management council would implement fishery management plans for any fishery sector that utilizes the public resource. It's confusing. And what I've garnered from it is that when you look at how a regional council say or the fishery service will have to interpret what the changes are, and then how do you translate that interpretation? And as we know, all federal legislation is not easily interpreted. But how will the Fisheries Service and our eight regional councils interpret those changes and translate them into policy and management decisions? It's difficult enough as it is. And going back to what Will Ward said, we knew the 2006 MSA reauthorization was tough love. And now I believe there are growing numbers of fishermen in my industry that understand the benefits of having that reauthorization. It hasn't been easy, but without the fish, we don't have a job. And that was kind of like, you know, Ford has a better idea. The light bulb went off in a lot of fishermen's minds that something like this in the long term, if you can hang in there, would be beneficial to their business. But it's tough enough for these regional councils to make policy and management and rulemaking, given the tremendous task of interpreting what changes in the law that there are.
And when go ahead, Holly. I'm sorry.
I'm just going to point out we've got some serious concerns with the legislation that was introduced recently, and I think the core concerns are that it would allow overfishing to continue on the most depleted fish populations, and that, in and of itself, that's not good for the fish, and it's not good for fishermen. It also puts data that's collected by government-funded scientists, so taxpayer dollars paid for data collected by government-funded scientists, would be off-limits to the public. And it would complicate management of snappers and groupers in the Gulf of Mexico by, you know, and make these rules really confusing. Mike just was talking about how, you know, it's complex enough as it is, and this would make it even more complex. And then finally, it would exempt some of the requirements that for how fishery rules are developed in such a way that would limit the public's opportunity to weigh in on these proposals. And so taken together, we think that this is just a really this is a bad starting point. It takes us backwards. It doesn't build on the success. It actually takes us back to the days when we had, you know, fewer limits and we had rampant overfishing, and that's a real concern.
So,
you know, John, if I could just follow up on what Holly said.
Absolutely.
I have, for the last 5 years, I have spent an inordinate amount of time out of my life as a wildlife and fishery biologist and a charter boat captain bringing fishermen to the table. I have taken table pounder after table pounder who didn't like this, didn't like that. I hate the government. They're all after me, and I don't like anything. I have, at great expense to my business and personal life, I've brought these fishermen to the table. I've told them, you can stay at the back of the bus all you want, but the view is a lot better at the front of the bus. You may not always get what you want, but it's time to come to the table with solutions and not problems. And I think this the draft language in MSA, from what I've have seen of the short pieces I've read of it, probably create more problems for us than solutions.
So it sounds like kind of across the board, this draft coming out of the House is leaves quite a bit to be desired. But do you think that this is going to end up being used as sort of a blueprint or a foundation for what eventually does get passed?
Well, I'm not an expert on the legislative process and all of the ins and outs. I've had an interesting view of it in the last 3 or 4 years. Who knows where House or Senate members are going to fall on this? We've been discussing this reauthorization now for almost 2 years. As I said, you know, we're trying to set the table for it. I think there'll be a lot of robust discussion over the next 6 months on where we go with this. My guess is the draft as it's written right now is not going to fly. I think there's going to have to be some changes, some accommodation. I don't see it as it's written as just merrily walking its way through the reauthorization process.
John, this is Bob. Could I weigh in here?
Absolutely, Bob Gill.
My view is slightly different than either Holly or Mike. And this House draft, as I view it, number one, it's complex. It's 30 pages and very difficult to read. You certainly can't do it as an easy read. But as Chairman Hastings stated, it's to start a national discussion on what's wanted on Magnuson reauthorization. So from that sense, it's a good document. Now, what it contains in there is going to be subject to a lot of discussion, a lot of debate. I think you'll see a lot of folks on different sides of the fence on each of the many issues that are in there. And we should not forget that the Senate version of that bill that will be forthcoming may be entirely different yet, and that will change the discussion. But I think the important factor here is, regardless of what's in that House draft version, is that the discussion gets started and the issues get fleshed out, and some will carry and some will not. And then ultimately, at the end of the day, it's going to have to get merged with the Senate version. So it's the first small step in a long process. And so from that standpoint, I think it's good. And to the extent that it generates that discussion, I think that's even better.
You know, and when it comes to catch limits and these, you know, stringent but it sounds like needed limits there, you know, going back to the cost of that for the fishing industry, you know, I had mentioned that Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Subcommittee meeting back in November, there was a charter boat captain from Florida, Robert Johnson, and he told the committee there that fishing fleets in his area, which is around St. Augustine, have experienced a roughly 50% decline in recent years. And I wanted to find out if that's something that you're experiencing as well here along Florida's west coast. Will Board?
John, in terms of the economics, you be mindful that there's different people affected differently.
Sure.
What I mean by that is that some folks will find regulations will affect them adversely, others will find it will benefit them. So we got to be very careful in terms of the whitewashing of whether or not it does one thing or another. How about it does many things,
okay.
Number one. Number two, in our industry, in particular, we've been under an IFQ program that has been, in some people's eyes, very helpful and beneficial. So there's been other tools in the chest that we've used in concert with the reauthorization of 2006 that have voted beneficially. I'm just always mindful. My perspective, John, is, and I know Bob has been in the industry for years as well, is you've got to be in this for the long haul. Well, what that means is that your perspective really has to be, how can I have this as a business for years and years to come, and can I leave this and hand this off to the next generation to be able to have the sustainability to do so as well? And so what I've done, John, really is looked at this from a perspective of economics and said, look, is there an economic rationale that can be made for making sure you have stringent enough measures in place to have strong, vibrant stocks? And when I've looked through the data unemotionally, and I've taken the time to do so, fishery by fishery, I've already done this analysis, and by the way, I have looked at Hastings still extensively, and I don't think it does what we need to do yet. And of course, Bob Gill's correct, though. It does start the dialogue. That's good. Because all of these things, you know, we have to get them out. Sunlight is the best sanitation. We have to talk about them. But in my perspective, and in the perspective of many others in the industry, in the seafood industry, not all of them, I don't speak for the entire industry, for sure I don't. But for some of us, at least anyway, it's about the long haul. And in the long haul, you have to be able to take a hit on the front end to benefit largely on the back end. And if we do, and if we can make it through that, a strong economic argument, although an ecological argument can also be made for it, but an economic argument can be made from an industry perspective for restaurants, the fishing industry itself, the charter boat, headboat industry, the private angler, recreational angler, that they have the benefits that they will be benefiting from years and years to come from now, 10 years out, 15 years out, 20 years out, even 5 years out. I think it are examples of 30-plus fisheries being rebuilt since 2006, turning those around on the national stage. John, that's huge. We haven't been able to do that. And if it wasn't for that reauthorization in 2006 with the ACLs, which is the annual catch limits, and having teeth in them, not just being able to let so much flexibility go into rebuilding that people can get away with what they wanted to by manipulating the process, I think it goes well for those that really are in this for the long haul. And so I guess that's always going to be my perspective, the long haul. And Dr. Bill Hogarth, the previous administrator of fisheries, and I have talked about this at length. He's agreeable, and I respect his scientific opinion enormously. He used to run the fishery service from D.C., also with the regional administrator here in the region. And Dr. Hogarth and I both share the view that we should try to, at least at best, try to stay somewhat the course, make some tweaks if they are absolutely necessary, and then add some issues that Ms. Binns had mentioned earlier about forage fish. That is something that ecosystems-based management and the whole complex issue of the fishery as a whole, or the system as a whole, has been something we've been avoiding for years that we have to incorporate also in the reauthorization.
All right. Thank you for that, Will. We are taking a short break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation exploring changes that could be coming from this year's reauthorization of the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery and Conservation Management Act and its economic and environmental impacts. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. We now continue our conversation on the reauthorization of the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery and Conservation Management Act and its future economic and environmental impacts. Our guests include Holly Binns with the Pew Charitable Trust, Will Ward with Captain's Finest Seafood in Tampa, Mike Colby with Double Hook Charters in Clearwater, and Bob Gill with Shrimp Landing in Ocala. Connect with our guests by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Post your comments or questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And since the health and sustainability of fish populations is the primary metric by which these catch limits are determined, is there concern over how accurately the federal government assesses the health of fish stocks? And Holly, I'll throw that one to you first.
Sure. I think that one of the challenges is that you can't, count every fish in the sea. That's just not the way it works. But there are a number of data sources that go into estimating the size and the fish populations, and looks at things like, how old do these fish live to be, and how many of these fish are at an age where they can, reproduce effectively. And so I think certainly what we have in terms of the way that we assess the status of these populations, is really pretty world-class science. I think the challenge in the Southeast is that we have so many species that we have not yet done these assessments for. And so there's an argument that's been made that if we haven't done, you know, a scientific study of the status of a population, that there shouldn't be a limit on the catch. But I think the thing to think about is flip that on its head and think about what we're saying when, you know, when folks urge that without a scientific study so you can set a precise limit, you know, that you shouldn't have a limit. That means that you would be fishing on some populations of fish with no idea of what the sustainable limit might be and no idea of whether you're really doing damage to that population. You know, you could be really fishing these species into a hole, which is incredibly economically painful to dig out from under. And so instead, what we've advocated is for species where you don't know if you have a problem or you don't have an assessment, set a limit, usually based sort of around where sort of the amount of landings that you've had in recent years, as sort of a cap. And that can be adjusted as we get more data, more information, more science, as you're, you know, able to do more studies of, you know, how healthy those populations are. But you don't want to, you know, sort of walk that close to the edge of a cliff with a blindfold on. You want to have some sort of sensible limit to make sure that you're not driving species into a hole, because that's why this has been so challenging in the Southeast to get a lot of these populations on the road to recovery. We had, both on the East Coast and in the Gulf, some of the worst overfishing problems in the nation. We had, you know, dozens or more species that have been chronically subject to overfishing. So, you know, taking them out of the water faster than they can reproduce for decades. And that meant that these populations had been driven to very low levels. And so the steps that were necessary to put them on the road to recovery meant a lot of sacrifice up front in the early years. And that's what we've been dealing with in the last 4 or 5 years. And, you know, we're starting to see some of the fruits of that sacrifice and some of the benefits. But certainly we don't want to, you know, turn the clock back and go back to just, you know, sort of uncontrolled fishing where we don't know what kind of damage we might be doing to these populations.
And one aspect of the last authorization of the MSA in 2006 calls for increased international cooperation, including increased efforts to address illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing and bycatch of protected marine species. Will Ward, do you know how those efforts have been going to work with other countries who might not have the same sort of regulatory protections in place?
Well, John, I've been working on legislation here in this country to make us more aware of the problem and what we can do in terms of the international agreements. That's something that ICAT and other fishery agreements in NATO will have to take up. But I can tell you that recent introductions of bills 269 and 267 in the Senate and H.R. 69 in the House are doing just that in terms of trying to stem the tide of the rampant increase in illegal and unreported and unregulated fishing by foreign vessels on international agreed to stocks and in U.S. waters as well. So I can speak to you about that issue in regards to the progress we've made, the recent introductions of that legislation has passed unanimously the Senate Commerce and Transportation Committee and is now seeking co-sponsors in the Southeast region and nationally to stop the illegal foreign fishing and illegal activities, not only fishing, mind you, human trafficking and drug smuggling by foreign vessels in U.S. waters and international waters as well.
Yeah, the last time we'd had you on the show, that was what we were talking about, this issue of foreign illegal fishing. You're saying even, you know, drug cartels are getting involved in this now.
That's correct. We have an increase. It's a cottage industry, John, and what's happened really is that they've used fishing vessels as lookouts for drug activity, for human smuggling, and also for the profit of just being able to poach international fisheries and U.S. fisheries, and then be able to bring those fish back to their ports or into U.S. ports and sell them under the guise of being a foreign-caught species. And that's something that's unconscionable to the U.S. seafood industry and also the U.S. recreational fishing industry, whether it be charter headboat or private anglers. So it is a growing problem. It is a growing problem in the Southeast. In particular, it's very, very problem on the Mexican-Texas border. We have the problem in Florida, poaching of lobsters, et cetera, finfish, reefish. So it's something that I've been working on, and we're hopeful that this year in this Congress we can get some things done on both the Senate Bill 269, Senate Bill 267, and on the House side, House Bill H.R. 69 to stem the tide of this illegal activity.
And when we had spoken back in August, those bills you just mentioned, the Pirate Fishing Elimination Act and the International Fishery Stewardship and Enforcement Act had been introduced. Have they made much progress since the last time we spoke?
We have not, but I will say we've made more, a lot of progress in the industry. In other words, folks from the commercial industry, folks from the recreational industry have been unified on this. There's not been one organization, John, that I've mentioned or talked to, and we've had over 90 national and local organizations have signed on letters of support, and we'll have well over 100 by the time we introduce the bill. I believe the letter to Congress, that bill will be being introduced here shortly within the next month, and we expect to have hearings on this in February and going through probably through March. But we do need local people to contact their congressmen, to contact their senators, and let them know that they support Senate Bill 269, 267, and the House version thereof, and to be engaged. In other words, John, it's really about people at the grassroots level speaking their voice about this. It's sad that we have to ask Congress to stop illegal fishing. It's sad that we have to ask Congress to stop illegal human trafficking and drug smuggling. But the realities of Washington, D.C. right now is that's what it is. And if you're not high on the radar screen, you're not going to get your issue known before the Congress. There's a lot of other issues they're going to be bringing before the Congress this year. So we're hopeful to keep the pressure on them, and I would encourage people to do so, to Congress, to contact their congressman to do so.
And as far as making sure that this issue, you know, is up on that radar, you know, the last time we had talked, you had described foreign illegal fishing as a problem that was growing, but that was relatively, I don't want to say hidden, but that people just didn't really know what was going on. Do you think that that has changed? Have you seen, you know, more media outlets sort of, you know, gauge interest in this and start talking about it?
Well, there's been a number of recent articles, John, that have come out, both the New York Times, articles in the Southeast region, law enforcement journal articles, et cetera, that have corroborated and supported our issue with this topic over a year ago. So it's nice to see that some people are finally starting to take notice of it. It's finally starting to get traction. And it's nice that you can corroborate that with independent sources of people telling you, you know what, you're on the right track, you're doing the right thing, and we encourage you and we want to support it. So I'm very excited about the progress we've made in terms of raising the public awareness about it. We still have much work to do. But I think for the first time in the last over a year I've been working on this, we have finally seen the ship turn around and people are now starting to take notice of it. And I'm very encouraged, but I want to let your listeners know that they need to contact their congressmen and their local governor's offices as well. This could be a state issue, state by state. The governors of these states vote quite a bit of power in D.C. and themselves, and they chime in on these particular issues as it relates to state issues being their sovereignty and their water issues as well.
And if we, you know, for some reason don't see movement on those two Senate bills we mentioned and the companion House measure, do you think that some aspect of the reauthorization of the Magnuson-Stevens could or should address foreign illegal fishing?
Well, here's my thoughts on John. Really simply, they're two separate mutually exclusive issues.
Uh-huh.
And it would be my hope that the International Fisheries Stewardship and Enforcement Act, that be Senate Bill 269, and the Pirate Fishing and Elimination Act, which is Senate Bill 267, that those would be issues that would be taken up well in advance of the Magnuson-Stevens Act issue. And I'll tell you why. First of all, they're completely unrelated in many ways. And number two, the politics of putting too many things together can sink both ships. And Magnuson reauthorization is going to be very, very contentious. It seems to be that it's heading to be a very, very difficult task to reauthorize, and the process will take months and months, if not years. Mm-hmm. These two bills, the International Fisheries Stewardship and Enforcement Act and the Pirate Fishing Elimination Act, neither of them are controversial. Neither of them are Republican or Democrat. How about they're both? For one, in a long time, we have an issue before the Congress that really can have bipartisan support. It's a nice change of pace that in D.C. we can finally get some things done. So we have Republicans and we have Democrats that see the value in this, see the value in the sovereignty of the United States government, see the value in protecting the sovereignty of this country in terms of its fisheries, but also in terms of the national security issues as it relates to human trafficking, drug smuggling, and who knows what else these folks could be bringing into U.S. ports. Remember, 9/11. Let's not forget that. So these two bills, I am hopeful, and will do all in my power to make sure that they move forward by themselves, separate and distinct from anything on Magnitsky reauthorization.
Gotcha. I did want to address, a criticism that I've seen come up regarding Magnuson-Stevens, and that has been the charge of poor enforcement or implementation of regulations under the MSA by these regional fishery management councils. Will Ward and Bob Gill, you both have experience serving with the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council. Is that really an issue?
I think enforcement is always an issue. We're not willing to devote the resources to provide the level of enforcement that we want. So the enforcement side of the equation, they work very hard at it, but they're relative to the problem understaffed. So that'll always be an issue unless the mindset changes, which I don't see happening. In terms of the implementation side, the process is quite long. It takes a year and a half to 2 years, typically, from start to implementation. That creates multiple problems, but that's partially and largely involving the public in the process, which slows things up, and is what is dictated by Congress. So it's not a question of something that the council can effectively change much. It can change some, but it's a long process, and you do want it to be of some length to give due deference and consideration to the issues at hand. You don't want to whip through them, come up with an answer, and have it implemented without thinking it through well, without hearing all the sides that weigh in on the issue. So there's some balance there that's required. I think we're overburdened right at the moment in terms of time, but it should take some time. So there's balances there, and of course, if you're eager to see a change, it's obviously not fast enough. On the other hand, if you don't want to see the change, it's going far too fast. Mm.
Is there any kind of timeline that you see, Bob, as to when reauthorization might occur? I mean, I know it's expected sometime this year, but can we narrow that down any more than that?
Well, I'm frankly skeptical that it'll get done this year.
Okay.
I'm targeting 2015 as the most likely time for that to occur. I'd be amazed if we could get together, as Will mentioned. It's very complicated. It's very controversial. It's difficult to go through the process. We have yet to see the Senate version of the reauthorization bill, and I don't have a time schedule for when that is going to appear. And so the discussion will reignite when that happens. So I think it'll be a challenge for them to get through this in this Congress. The earliest likely, in my mind, is 2015.
Okay. And I had mentioned, congressional hearings on the issue back in November when stakeholders could, testify before federal lawmakers. Will we see more opportunities for stakeholders to maybe make their case about what should or should not be in the MSA? And if so, is that something that you plan to participate in, Bob?
Well, very definitely. There's a hearing being scheduled for the Natural Resources Committee in the House for February 4th, and there will be multiple opportunities. There's some workshops being planned around the nation to discuss Magnuson. So the opportunity is there, and I would encourage those that are interested in the fisheries and making sure that the Magnuson reflects their priorities and their desires. Get out there and get themselves involved in that discussion, and the more, the better the end product will ultimately be.
And Mike Colby, do you think that's something you would be interested in doing, testifying before lawmakers, given an opportunity to talk about what should or should not be in the MSA?
Well, I certainly would take advantage if invited. I still believe that there are things that members of that Natural Resource Committee want to hear, and they want to hear it from stakeholders. Not assuming that I could represent every charter fisherman in the state of Florida, which I certainly don't. I think there are a lot of fishermen that would like to see somebody on their behalf go in and talk about these issues. Again, it's been a pleasant journey for me being involved in these issues and seeing fishermen who are now beginning to understand the long-term benefits of things that we've done in fishery management over the last 7 years. And to be able to bring that to the table, I think it'd be a great opportunity.
And Holly Benz, what about you? This report from Audubon of Florida and Pew Charitable Trust, is that something that you would like to go into the record as lawmakers consider future regulations in the MSA?
I think that certainly we'd like to see consideration of the ways to ensure the health of the ocean food web. And I think that they need to hear from diverse stakeholders. Certainly, protecting forage fish has been something where there's been a lot of agreement between, conservation interest and recreational fishermen and commercial fishermen, in places around the country. And so I think that, to me, should be one of the things that would be, probably one of the easier lifts, one of the least controversial, things to include in this next version of the law.
And the information in this Fins and Feathers report, is that something else or something that you would like to see also used, say, perhaps for lobbying state lawmakers? We've got our state legislative session coming up in March.
Sure. This is a report that we've shared with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, which is the state agency that is responsible for rules on fishing and on protecting birds in the state of Florida. We're looking forward to sitting down and talking with them in more detail about how we can take the information in that report and put it to good use.
All right. Well, that is about all the time we have for today's show, but I want to thank my guests. Holly Benz is a research director with the Pew Charitable Trust. A link to Pew and Audubon Florida's recent study on forage fish is available on our website. Also, thanks to Captain's Finest Seafood CEO, Master Captain, and Gulf Fishermen's Association Board of Directors member Will Ward. We've also been speaking with Captain Mike Colby of Double Hook Charter in Clearwater. Mike, thanks so much for joining us as well. And lastly, thanks to Bob Gill, owner of Shrimp Landing and member of the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council's Scientific and Statistical Committee. Thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thank you, John.
There's more information on today's show, as well as an archive of past shows at our website, wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. To comment on anything you've heard on this or any edition of the program, send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Thanks to my producers, Luke Martin and Richard Chinqui. This is WGCU, Fort Myers, Naples, Sarasota, 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.